Hello and welcome to the Miko Bits show, and I'm your host, Miko Bits. Today we have Brooks Brown, super exciting and visionary game designer and storyteller. We're going to be learning quite a lot about his exciting project relating to things like NFT, permanence, mortality, immortality, life and death, many themes I'm super interested in. So, let's just jump right in. So, Brooks, welcome to the Miko Bits show.
Thank you for having me. It's about time. I mean, we've been trying to sort of have this happen and have random talks, and I know I've just been slammed, so I apologize, but thanks for finally having me on. I'm excited to see where we get.
Yeah, wonderful. No, of course. And, you know, I definitely understand, being busier than a one-legged man in a butt-kicking contest. So, you know, I definitely get that. Super glad to have you. So, you know, I guess first and foremost, I think the audience would love to kind of get your perspective of, like, you know, how did you get here? You know, I know there's like an official story, but I think people want to hear like more like the interesting stuff, you know, like what are the seminal moments in your life and, you know, how did you get to where you are?
Well, it's the story of how people get to their careers I've always found interesting. For me, because I've always, people tell stories of amazing feats of effort. And, me, it's kind of, it's no shortage of that. 100-hour weeks were no issue. But a lot of it is kind of due to accident and happenstance, and as well as falling upwards. There's a really strange thing that happens at companies that are large enough that they really hate to replace someone if they don't have to. So when your boss quits and you end up taking on all their work, they're very happy to not pay you more, to give you a title, and to not hire anyone in your place. And that kind of is actually how a lot of my, you know, early work happened, especially at Lucas. Lucas was notorious for this kind of thing. I was brought in. They didn't believe that there was really a big need in 2005 and 2006 for there to be a lot of websites for products and for games and things like that. The 2000s were a very different time. It's the kids may not remember because there's a lot of websites that did exist, but the internet was a thing that was kind of still sort of seen as the nerd's domain. Like it really wasn't a thing for broad audiences. Oh, we don't really need something there. We need a brochureware site. You know, we need picture and an image and we're done. And that's kind of what Lucas did for a long time. And then I was brought on like, hey, you know how to code. We're wanting to do more. And then when my boss quit, I got to be digital marketing manager and head of digital marketing in general for all of LucasArts, which is no small thing. It's my dream job, kind of. And the way that worked out was weird. On the one side, I kind of brought social media to Star Wars, which was its own thing. Lucasfilm didn't want to be on social media. I almost got fired for registering them on social media just so we'd own at Star Wars, at LucasArts. We didn't even get LucasArts. We got LucasArts games because some poor little kid, and I was like, I'm not DMCAing a child who literally draws his art and then posts it. His name is Lucas. LucasArts.
That's adorable. That's awesome.
I'm not going to DMCA that.
Like, crush him like a bug.
Yeah. That's, yeah, I'm not George Lucas. I don't do those things. So the whole thing was interesting on that side. And then the other side was they would not really want to do anything interesting. And my favorite moment I had was I actually won a Webby for my Lego Star Wars online game, which was kind of like a 10-20 person at a time MMO instanced sharded thing that you just ran around, and it was for little kids. It wasn't complex, but it was a lot of like really fun little sort of Transformice type gameplay where you'd, you know, put up a bridge, you'd build bricks, or you'd knock them down and other people would fall. We had physics in it. It was really fun. And but the rule was at Lucas that you couldn't be on the cloud. That was not allowed.
No clouds.
Everything had to be in the basement.
server room.
Yeah, which was a sizable server room, because this not just housing our websites, but housing all of Star Wars Online, but also all of our email and all of Industrial Light and Magic, who this time were working on some pretty serious Hollywood films. Yeah. And they didn't want anything outside the walls. They were really nervous about content on other servers. And so when I started going, you can't build something like this and have it run on those on an internal setup. The in and outs and the calls for assets alone would destroy something. And I was like very open about this, and they were clear that no cloud. And I was like, okay, so we built two versions. We built one for internal, and then we built one that would run on Rackspace. And I warned everyone how the internet worked, and everyone in the online group was like, this is, what are we doing? Why are you doing this to us? Like, I was like marching them to the edge of a cliff. And when the site went live, we hit, I think within the first day, we broke 200,000 people, like almost at the same, like concurrent. I mean, it's Star Wars. You have huge numbers.
Yeah.
But how I knew the website went up is because everyone's email stopped working and everyone's internet stopped working because it's one pipe in, one pipe out. So I went, all right. And I went out for a cigarette and sat down, and soon all of Industrial Light and Magic, who smoked, came outside because the internet was down for the entire company.
And, nice,
and I was like, okay, well, I'm going to be fired. Like, it was just, this is it. I wasn't right away, which was good. They let me flip that switch. I was like, I can get us on the cloud. I was, oh, look, it's fine. And everything kind of went back to real life. But it was this moment of like, oh, I actually can build things. Up until this point, I'd always had a dream of being a game designer ever since I was little. My brother and I, when we played Monkey Island, that was the game we went, this is all we want to do. My brother, lo and behold, ended up, he's a sound designer. He spent the last few years on Call of Duty. So he's a very good game designer, very good sound designer. Also musician, but sound designer for sure. And we both got to work on the Monkey Island reboot of all things. So this was like our dream. And I always wanted to be a designer. And I finally got my chance with this. And then lo and behold, that led me into, it was deeply successful. And at that point, Paul, who was the CEO of Lucas at the time, the president, he gave me my own games team. And he was like, here's a pitch. And we started working on a project called Universe that never saw the light of day, like a million things at Lucas at that time. We were all part of the great crunch as they decided to prepare for the Disney sale.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Build whatever you want. Have fun. Just keep going. Now your projects are all canceled. We're selling. It's been fun, which was just great.
Wow.
But in that time, I was fortunate to make a significant impact on a handful of executives, and was recommended to work for James Cameron, which I out of nowhere got this call of like, hey, I'm Kathy Franklin, president over here at Lightstorm. And I was like, I don't know what that is. Like, I know. it's James Cameron's production company.
Yeah, apparently.
Oh yes. Hello. How can I help you? Like, well, we had you recommended to us, and we wondered if you'd be interested in talking to us about taking over digital for the Avatar franchise, video games, streaming, all of it digital. And I was like, yes, please. And after a handful of flights to LA and interviews and phone calls, I moved to LA and was very fortunate to work with. A lot of people go to college. I skipped that. And I look at my time at Lucas was like really a boot camp because I launched 18 like products or marketing campaigns in 4 years. It was a brutal batan, like death march of marketing. You never stop. And a lot of it was putting lipstick on pigs, like The Force Unleashed 2. And this is not against the team. This is against the management at Lucas, because they just screwed that up beyond words. But we knew it was not good. It was terrible, actually. We had to sell it. We had a QA guy who like a few weeks before launch beat the game in 45 minutes without doing anything special. Ooh, or like glitchy run. Bullshit. Yeah, it wasn't even like a good speed run. He just was like, oh, I'm just doing this. It's like, oh, for Christ's sake. Oh, God. What happens? A 9-month dev cycle will do a lot of shit to a game, especially a AAA game like that was intended to be.
Yeah, so, yeah.
You know, the team did everything they could, but they didn't care. They were ready to sell to they were just, they didn't care. Money. So it was just very frustrating.
Ouch.
And so it was like this boot camp. But working for Jim, I was able to like sit back and like learn. And just absorb, because Kathy, who was my boss there, probably probably the smartest person I've ever worked for.
What are the strange, he seems like a really different human. Like what are the strange things about him? Anything?
I mean, not really. He's very lovely. He has his edge if you fuck up, just like the rumor, like he is everything people say. I think he has a really interesting air to him that personally, what I saw consistently with him was a weird humility, a humility that's baked in arrogance, which I don't think makes sense when I say it out loud. He's done the biggest things in the history of the fucking world. So it's not like you just can't have that normal human conversations. But at the same time, like one of my favorite memories is the writers are working on the new Avatar scripts. This was early on. And they wanted all the info they could on what had come out with the first film. And the Avatar game that Ubisoft put out, which was just awful, just fine, just awful. They asked me to, he asked me to play it for them and show them the whole game. And so I spent a full day. It was literally an entire day of my life sitting with James Cameron and the writers as Jim roasted his own franchise in front of me by making fun of this game. It was hilarious. It was Mystery Science Theater 3000, but it was very strange, but it was like this continuous back and forth of like, oh, wow, why did they do that? Oh, what? That makes like just laughing about it. But like, it was kind of the thing at Lightstorm. And it's the thing I've carried through to my current company. I mean, so many things, but you couldn't really get in trouble for asking a lot of stupid questions. Like it was a big deal to like, just ask and talk about things and maybe not externally. Don't do that in front of other people, but like inside the family, you're free to say anything you want. Outside the family, we're all gods as far as anyone's concerned. And I really appreciated it. And, you know, like I said, Kathy is brilliant, really understood franchises and how to make them and how to get people to think through them, understood the nuances of business and politics inside of things. Because we were partnered with Fox, which was a massive matrixed organization with its own issues. And then you also had like John Landau, who really ran everything there. Well, Jim kind of got to be Jim, which was awesome. And John was too much information I could gain from him. Hilarious. He's the kind of person who would show up to every meeting, and he was on his phone. He was wearing Crocs and he was wearing his Tommy Bahamas. Like that's every meeting. But yet he wasn't not paying attention. He was involved and everyone, and he loved talking and he loved, you know, having those conversations. It was just like a learning process of how to deal with people, how to do business, how to think big. And then the other half of that, which is when anyone would be able to work on Avatar. And that's because everything so far I'm talking about is like business and interpersonal, which is great. But when you start to world create and how they think about it, I've never experienced that anywhere else.
It's how
they go about it. A lot of places they'll sit and they'll have like, oh, I want to create a character here. Let's create this here. Oh, I need X and Y. But like during my interview, Jim, I think put it best. He said, it's a big deal that we have an ecosystem because if I want a desert, I can't just go make some yellow planet, which is a nice day.
Yeah.
Because it's accurate. It was, how do things fit together? How do they work? What is the knock-on effects of every choice you make? And that's how everyone talked about everything we did. And that kind of super like hyper systemic thinking, I kind of came from, I mean, the world of, you know, sort of deep web, the web coding as a thing is intended to be systemic. As we moved into web 2.0, that was the big thing, is you could make these projects that would slowly filter in and people would move across them. So if you could build something that was a little bit more systemic, it was interesting. Also, video games, I happened to be working alongside people who deeply believed in systemic video games. And so I was able to spend a lot of time sort of learning why systemic is better and becoming a bit of a zealot. I'm a huge zealot in a lot of things, but this one I'm really big in. And so with Jim, everything, all the artists, every artist thought about things like hyper systemically. And it was, at first it was very painful for me because I didn't, coming from Star Wars doesn't give a shit about that at all.
Midichlorians.
Yeah. It's like, whatever, we'll figure it out. Just put something in there. We'll figure it out with the next script. And that's very much like, if I said something like that, I think I'd have been fired.
It's great. That's great. That's great for like J.J. Abrams, right? Because it's sort of like just sort of spaghetti-ish. Like it's sort of like Lost. It's sort of like, oh, Lost. Okay, we're all lost. Yes. We're all lost with you. Like
we'll figure it out later is not a thing.
You're lost. Exists. We're lost. We're all lost. You know, it gives you that feeling of being lost, and you know, and it's because they're lost. But tell me about your project. So you know.
In the background of all of this, you know, I went through some, if you want the slight personal edge, I went through a serious trauma when I was in high school. I was a student at Columbine, and there's like this massive side of like having to deal with death, having to figure out how people find meaning into things. I've never been able to sort of do a thing for fun. Like it's not fun to be my friend. My poor wife has to deal with it, I'm sure. But like, I don't do things for fun. I care about things a little bit too much, probably. It's a compensation. And so all of this stuff, I'm constantly trying to find, how do we find meaning into things? How do I play with death and all of these things? And this culminated right before this project. I did a VR piece that won Tribeca. I got to be a director at Tribeca and Sundance, which is wild. Won both. And we won a Lumiere for a piece where we put you in a corner market in Syria and we blew you up.
Oh my God.
And we killed everyone around you, and you had to, as a walk around Unreal based VR. So backpacked, we built walls, we built a bunch of stuff. We built a room that was on fire that you had to go through, through another blown out area and across like a very, you know, 3-story high beam, a lot of the VR tricks, but ultimately to where a little girl and her father were screaming because she's under rubble and you need to lift the rubble physically off of her. Like,
oh my God,
lift it. And, to make it really drive home, we had an actress there who you'd see in VR, but you didn't know was real. And as you reached for it, she'd reach out and she'd grab your hand. And we had people collapse emotionally. It was awful. Like, we kind of probably shouldn't have done everything we did. There's a really great paper called Dark Tourism that a professor who I've gotten to know since did, that is like, hey, this is, this might be a bit much. And he's right. I think he's right. But it was really a lot for me to be able to like have people experience a traumatic event safely, which is what I wanted to do. Yeah. So playing with death has been a thing. And the current project, Nor, welcome to Nor.com, kind of carries that through, because I've been doing random crypto consulting, and I've been a fan of the ideas of crypto for like a decade. Less a fan of how things have turned out and how things have actually been made. Primarily the idea of it's going to change everything. Also, here is roulette wheels is kind of like, really? This is the vision. The vision is Vegas and I'm
casino. Yeah. Sorry.
And I did that. I've done that. I've seen it. Vegas has its place. I'm not like against it, but that's not interesting. And it's not good for the world. Like, it's not like we're going to make the world better by making more casinos. So like, I got tired of that. My current project kind of stemmed out of me trying to figure out underneath it all how this thing actually works. Because one of the things that happens a lot in technology, I learned this in VR heavily, but this is true of game engines. This is true of literally anything, social media. There's no such thing as like a ball of code that is unchangeable. There's a shit ton of little tiny files that all are programmed to do a thing that tell another file to do a thing, and they kind of grow. And so if you can kind of break those apart, figure out how they actually really work, you can rearrange them a little bit and change what some of them say. And it changes a significant amount of the outcome. Well, with crypto, I believe this is very powerfully the case. NFTs as a thing, how they've ended up and been used, I'm super not a fan. I think, the idea of, just in general, a lot of things. I mean, I don't want to be hypercritical. There's a lot of stuff people are trying. When you have engineers running stuff, which is the case with a lot of crypto, it was the case with VR, they tend to just charge ahead. And I come from design, and design, our job is to kind of help refigure that. And so when you have like the world's ugliest apes as like the most expensive, best thing in the history of the world, it's like, well, let's pull back. When you have, play to earn games doing what they're doing, it's like, hey guys, gold farming, like we've done this, we know how this turns out. It doesn't end well. Like, no one's proud of gold farming as a thing in WoW. Like, it's a necessary evil. Can we sit back? And there's some cool things NFTs do that people are not really paying attention to. Like one of those is the fact that, well, there is the joke, oh, I right-clicked your NFTs and saved it. That's actually like one of the coolest things about crypto, that I own things that are public and available, which is weird. Normally, if I buy a piece of art, I own it. It's in my house. I have ugly paintings from friends and my own on my walls. You're not going to see them. I'm not going to tilt it. I own them. I get to control who sees them. It's not really true with NFTs. They're kind of public and they're collectively owned, even though I own them. And so it's a really strange, that's a strange thing we don't know how to handle yet. Like we really don't understand it. The other thing they do is they add a thing to an image. So a lot of people confuse the idea of the NFT is the image. It's not. And I know I'm speaking to the choir here, but it's a slightly sure. different train of thought on it. It's a receipt, we say often. So not really the image, it's a receipt for the image, which is true. But I even would add one more step. What it does is it adds permanence.
Yeah.
There's a thing, and there's no such thing as a real image, which sounds weird, but on my hard drive, I have a million JPEGs. Anytime I've saved one, anytime I've moved it, anytime it's done, there's no image sitting there. It's a big bag of code that is waiting to be interpreted by an interpreter that is displaying it to me. This yep. video is not going to sit on my hard drive or yours. It is a collection of garbage that an interpreter has to show in order to show me the video. And so as such, the original video is not really a thing. That doesn't exist in the digital world. They're being moved all the time and deleted. I use the analogy of Star Trek. Every time you transport, is it a copy of Kirk or is it really Kirk? This is, it's a copy. We murder Kirk every time he's sure. transported. And so it's, when you start talking about it like that, NFTs have a lot of properties that are fun. And for us, I wanted to embrace with my first prototype and now with our entire platform, the way that NFTs add that permanence, but I want to add it where I think it's the most important, which is you and me, not items or objects. I think items or objects, probably we can do interesting things with, but the most interesting is the ability to give you and I permanence in any space. I have a Facebook account. I have a name. Sure. I also have three other fake Facebook accounts. I have one that's like a hyper-conservative lunatic because I really find that stuff interesting, conspiracy theories and all that stuff. So I have like one account that just does that all day. is that like, it's bullshit, but at any point it can get banned. I'll create another one. It doesn't matter to me. But NFTs add permanence to me. They add specificity. They add identity that is really powerful. And so in our world, in our project, this is the core foundation. People join, they get these NFTs for free, players. And you play the games, they're also free. We don't have in-game items. We don't do the play-to-earn thing of, oh, well, there's a +2 sword that you can get if you kill this rat 9 million times. Maybe you'll get it once and you can make, you know, pay for rent at the end of the year. We're much more just play games, have fun. It's a weird idea, fun in games. I know, we'll get to that, I promise. But for us, it's like, just let people play. And then we have our tournament system, which is what ties into our economy. And I'll get into that kind of in a bit. But the tournaments use this. They use the way that NFTs work. So when you or I join, if we lose, we kill the NFT, that we burn it. And that thing is so different because I'm attached to it. It has permanence. It's not like a normal, oh, I died in Diablo permadeath, which is bad enough and kind of sucks, but also I'll just start again. It doesn't really matter. Or I'll save scum or like there's a million things I can do to sort of fake that. There's zero ways to get around it for an NFT. You can't copy them. If it dies, out the door and you're screwed. And that hyper permanence of death, to go back to where I kind of started, this is the thing I want to play with. I want to kind of return an understanding of what death can mean to us. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It can be a driver. It's a minima moralia. Yeah. Never forget that you can die. And that's pretty much the ethos of the project. We have a lot of other stuff I'm happy to get into. That's my ramble of kind of how I got there. I haven't done that story before in that way. So I hope it made sense, but it's...
No, it's really terrific. It sounds dark.
It's a lot of death, man. It's a lot of death. Jesus.
No, but to me, like, it's so deeply important and resonant, right? Because in a sense, like, it's inseparable from story. Like if you go back to Homer and you go back to the Iliad and the Odyssey, right, there's the mortals and the immortals, right? But the whole purpose of having immortals is to show a contrast with the mortals, right? And so in a way, like, you know, because the readers are presumably mortals, right? So,
and any story world, death, when death matters or doesn't matter, it changes the entire space. And totally. And my argument would be I would contrast Marvel's entire oeuvre versus Game of Thrones. The moment that Marvel kills people off, which has happened multiple times, but then they bring everyone back and they can totally do it at any time. It does this thing where it's like, oh, because I was really upset when Spider-Man died, but he's cool. So what? Then the next time they do that,
well, there's money like, to be made. So they yeah, bring back.
I mean, comics have always done this. They always reboot and bring the character back. So it doesn't really matter. It's the old sitcom joke of everything at the end of the episode is the same as it ever was because you never really want to change stuff. That versus Game of Thrones, one of the reason I don't actually think it's particularly good writing, but I think the reason that it attaches to people is it opened with an episode where the dude you thought was the main character is fucking killed.
Yeah. And
you know, from there you're like, what? Well, like, there's no coming back. Like there's no coming back from the way he died. So it's like, okay. Right.
And going back to kind of like the Lucas thing, like one of the crazy things that happened as a result of this kind of lack of systems theory, right, is that there ended up being this entire universal rule that stormtroopers couldn't harm anyone, right? That became a rule. It became a de facto inductive rule, right? And they had to launch an entire movie, Rogue One, where the stormtroopers actually kill people, and they just set up these fake characters that could be killed because no one cared about them, you know? And so the whole movie is like a palate cleanser of like, oh, by the way, stormtroopers can kill people, you know? And then
until the next movie where we have actors that have 3-year or 3-4 contracts.
Correct. And now we're back. And now we're back to Star Wars. Like that was a little bubble.
And that's, you know? And we get to the running gag with the new Star Wars film, which is nobody ever dies.
Yes.
And that's, there is that underlying thing of like, hey, so Luke died? Did he really? Do you think he's gone? I don't know. Like, did we really? Oh no, Luke's gone forever. Leia's gone because they're not because fucking the Emperor. What? Like, it's just these really strange moments of like, oh, okay. So why become attached to any moment? It loss and endings, stories change. And if we don't allow them to change, which is the case, stories, I mean, I don't know if you want me to get into semiotic theory, but the way that we make sense of stories is with lots of little bits, and those bits change over time. And we, as we read, place them in an order, and we kind of exist in between the different series of things that we place. And this is how we sort of make meaning out of stuff. So when things drop in or out, that gives us the variability that we actually have a story. Otherwise, it's everything flying at us all the time, which isn't how it works. Our lives are not this. I can tell you, as I just did earlier, the story of how I got here. I could tell a million versions of that. Like, I literally could tell, like, just every way. I could chalk it up to I'm the hardest worker that's ever lived, and no one has ever worked harder. I am the smartest man who's ever been. No one shall ever eclipse me. I accidentally got a job that I probably shouldn't have. And I ended up in a position I probably shouldn't have gotten. And lo and behold, I was able to live up to it a little bit. That's probably more honest, but it's still my version of it. Someone else will absolutely tell a different story. So this variability of the ups and downs is what makes it. If everything's flat, there's no meaning for me or you or any of us to get. And death is one of those things that allows that. It's our story world is based in this. This is literally the exploration we're taking with the whole story world, which is about immortality, about how these things play in our world. There's a handful who have lived millions, maybe billions of years. Time doesn't matter anymore. The nine immortals, and they basically have tried over and over to find a way to have a perfect society, free of death. Well, that what they've learned is that they can't. It's just not possible because at some point there's a heat death that happens to society when you don't have loss, when everything just piles or sits or there's no threat. If you had no need to eat, have sex, carry on your genes, you never were going to die, you didn't age, you'd sit around after a while, like you'd do a whole bunch of cool stuff, and then you'd probably sit around and then you'd wait. And that's kind of what happened. And so their thing is less about discovering immortality, which they were very proud of at first, but more discovering mortality and how it plays into how they work. And the mortality is us. We join them and we put ourselves on the line and we make things interesting again. It's a play on how video games, death means nothing. I've died millions of times. There's a handful of times where I've died that kind of meant something, and it's mostly in experimental weird games. But like I was playing called Warzone the other day, and like I often do, I didn't like the group I was in, so I kind of ran at the nearest group and got shot in the face and died so I could start over. Like, it happened. I'm not alone in this. It's a shitty thing to do, but it's everyone does this. This is, death doesn't really matter. It's like, okay, cool, I'll go do the next round. And that's, with that, there's knock-on effects to the meaning of how I do things. One of the moments in Avatar that I was really fascinated with trying to find a way to make work in video games is, and it's not an unusual thing, Jim in all of his films, he has a thing of self-sacrifice. But how do you do self-sacrifice in a video game and have it mean something in a multiplayer game? Because again, if we go to Warzone, if you and I are on a team and I dive in front of some bullets and I die, you're not going, whew, Brooks, wow, what a hero. I'm never playing with this fucking guy again. Like you don't care because that doesn't matter. So there's these knock-on effects of like, I can't have those powerful moments with my friends. The same way I can even have in a basketball court as a thing, I can go have these moments because injury, because physical stress, because the reality of going through a thing is a thing that video games just also don't have. So there's like, where do we draw this line? How do we find a new way to have these things become powerful, have these moments in video games become real, and do it without, I'm a big critic of the play to earn sort of general way of doing things. I'm not condemning it or think it's like awful. Like I don't say those kinds of things, but it's the first try. And it's like, I look at VR, the early work in VR versus the stuff they did later versus the stuff I did versus the stuff people who saw me. Everything is an evolution. We build off of each other's work. It's the nature. So if we're not free to criticize and build and do that, we're not going to ever get anywhere. Someone's going to figure out what I'm doing is shitty in some way and do something better. That's how this goes. And so with Play to Earn, a lot of that stuff is they've just taken the NFTs and taken what I consider, because it again, they're playing with permanence, value, scarcity, but they're taking to me the worst parts of our world. Like, it's my joke I always had when I was in VR was, why is everyone wanting to just copy the shittiest things? Say, hey, let's do a concert in VR. Awesome. What does that mean in VR? Oh my God. Well, we want to have seats and we want you to be in Staples Center. What? Why? Why? Why would you? Well, we want everyone to pay for seats because we like scarcity. It makes us more money. Yeah, but we don't have to have that because people can physically take up the same space in the digital world. They can do that. They don't even have to know each other's there. In fact, let's do away with the idea of concerts altogether. They only exist because an artist needs to travel in order to go to all the cities for their concerts. So we can just get rid of that and change what it means. No, 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 no. You want to do this because it's safe and easy and we know it. That is where I kind of get bothered. And so when we have like Play to Earn, which is basically jobs, like they're not really games, they're jobs. And I mean, they're better than working in some terrible places. So there's a reason it works with the global poor. But, you know, my old joke, Americans don't gold farm. Like, we know this. Like, there's countries we know where the gold, we know where the gold farming happens. And that's not a thing to me that I think we should be striving for. It should be a thing we go, okay, we've enabled it. We're raising people out of poverty. Happy day. Fucking, I love that. But let's figure out how these pieces work and now take a step where we can have everyone take part in something that's more interesting, that can still generate money. And so that's, our economy is based around that, where we do enable DeFi, proper finance, which I'm not lacking in entertainment of, the ability for us to have people go in and do the DeFi thing, do the NFT thing, play with speculative markets and throw around capital is necessary. It's how we're going to generate cash. But how we do it is by removing it entirely from the game And this is kind of our thing with PlayFi and the thing we're trying to sort of push for, where the economy, we consider a game. And we consider the games, and we're going to have many, also games. And just like you wouldn't want to get your baseball in your World of Warcraft, unless you did a World of Warcraft baseball game, which would be cool, you want to keep them fairly separate. They're different games. I think the same is true of the economy. The whales, when they play, how they play is by spending money. I feel free to watch streams of whales who proudly talk about the money they're spending in whatever weird nightmare new free-to-play game where they spend $10,000 to $15,000 a month, which is insane. But hear how they talk about it. They don't talk about a game like I play. They don't give a shit about that. Right. They're min-maxing. That's their thing. They're Warhammer players who don't know they're Warhammer players. Like their whole thing is, you know, if I buy this, where I get my most dollar is I do it through the runes. But if I use the runes, but if I haven't purchased this, I don't get the bonus. So I first have to buy this.
Yeah, money gaming.
The puzzle. That's their game. They love that. And it's exactly the same thing stock market people do. It's literally the same game.
Like I showed a friend Cookie Clicker because I wanted them to understand DeFi. So I said, here, play this idle clicker, you know? And the thing that happened was he came back with a spreadsheet and he was like, you know what the best value per cookie is the wizard towers. He's like, wizard towers are like the best value for cookie. So he's like, so I bought only wizard towers. And it's like, that's what a weird reaction to that game.
But it's super not uncommon. Any of these games that have this sort of weird side to it have that. Dota 2 is a non-economy game. All of the items have an economy on the Steam marketplace, but that marketplace has people who that's all they do, and they do things in order to boost different items. They play the game of trying to increase value. Recently there was a video where someone Action Slacks is the streamer's name, Sir Action Slacks, and he put on an outfit that no one wears for Axe, and they called him the Diaper King, and it was like a super meme-y joke. And lo and behold, the speculative people who are playing the market bumped it and social mediated it and memed it and then sold a bunch and bought a bunch from different, like, that's their game. And I appreciate game. I do. I appreciate play. I don't care where it is. I'm not anti-capitalist in that sense. To me, the problem is when we start mixing them. When the game I'm playing, let's say we're playing a shooter and I love it, is mixed with the economy game, because that screws two people. First, I play these games to become better at them. Like that's skill and growth is the reason I think most people play games, is to get better at them and to feel a sense of achievement. But if I'm playing against someone who's bought a $10,000 gun that kind of puts them on par with me, I don't get to improve because I don't know what I need to improve. It's impossible for me to know. If I'm just playing against a normal person, I can go, okay, I'm able to gauge where their skill is at, and I'm able to kind of figure things out and hone and, you know, place myself in coordinates against that person. But if they're just buying an item, I don't know if it's the item, if it's them, if it's me, where I'm failing, and I can't improve. I can't judge, and I get lost in this miasma.
Yeah. The way I reason about this is two things. I talk about first-class gameplay, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, if you look at Axie, there is a wealth game, but the wealth players actually don't have first class gameplay, right? What they do is they buy stuff for people who do get first class gameplay, which are the time/devotion actors, right? But like, to me, like, it is the good thing about that system is that it's a non-toxic interaction between two different classes of players. It's just the wealth player has no first class gameplay, right? But to me, like, you know, if you can create a system where there's a non-toxic interaction between two perfectly honorable, whether it's fame, skill, money, time, you know, these different dimensions of value, right? And respect and honor, right? If you can create non-toxic or even mutually supportive interaction, scholarship is a supportive interaction, right?
So scholarship edge to it in that there is a power dynamic that is implicit in it that's troublesome. And it's not necessarily always bad, but it is to the point where one of the reasons Axie has gotten to the point where it is, I saw someone who runs a scholarship program. He said, I have eight people. I make $20,000 a month and it's not as much as I used to. And then on the other hand, we have the players who we now know the current state of how much SLPs is for sale.
Yeah.
They're not even making poverty wages anymore.
Like, yeah.
But the problem between that is this guy's making 20,000 amongst eight people. And if he were to the amount of money he could share back to them, or their share of how much they work, could be a bit more, they'd be happy. They'd be surviving very well. Axie would be in a better place. But this is where you have that. I'm here for myself, and everyone is, and I'm not necessarily faulting that. Like, we're very unaware of other people. And so that challenge, that power dynamic, I think is where we want to play, because there's the other side, and that's the economy people. You say they, I love how you phrase that they don't get the gameplay.
First class.
It's true. And yeah, because the other side of that is we also lie to them, because them buying an item that makes them better or makes them stronger. In the scholarship program, they don't even get to play, which I think is fine-ish, but they sort of do play and they're really intertwined. It's not management the best version. Sim. Yeah. The second half of that, though, is there are a lot of straight buy an item and you're better than other people. And now that person who bought that, they can't tell if they're good or how to improve. If you ever need to know, go try an aimbot. There are games out there that allow them that don't have good anti-cheat. Go try an aimbot. And then tell me how you're good. Then come play with me on a regular server. You'll get fucking smoked. Like it's because you don't know where the bonus is. We can't do this. Our brains don't work that way. Michael Jordan, if he had the ability to pay 20 extra bucks in order to have faster shoes or to jump higher, wouldn't know where his jump ends and the shoes begin. That's how it works. We don't have this ability. So we have kind of a lot of weird dimensions to this. The Axie thing, specifically what you're talking about, though, is the inspiration behind our project. And again, this is why I don't want to shit on Axie too much. I do, because I don't like a lot of the stuff that they're doing, and I think there's a lot of mistakes they made, but it's like a loving criticism. It's not a, it's a, because what by doing the scholarship thing, which is more of an accident than anything, they didn't plan for any of this project to explode as it did. They tried a thing, and now they're billionaires, which is kind of hilarious, and I love stories like that. The separation of play and management is where I went, that's actually where we can have fun. The management sim on the Axie thing is, to me, is bad. It's bad. It's not a good management sim. It's not a real full-fleshed thing, because it was just kind of a stopgap, because they ended up having people who were just getting priced out of the Axie market.
Right.
So this was their solve.
Right.
So what if we were to build that way from the beginning? Because what you're talking about is multiple magic circles of games. We have the Axie player. We have the players who are playing the video game and killing stuff. Let's say for us, it's they're runners, they're shooting, they're fighting, they're doing a fighting game. Any specific game, great. But then we also have this other one, which is an economy game, like straight up.
Yep.
So draw a circle around it. Make it really tight and powerful, and actually make it wild, like go way over the line. Like, just, there's no point in holding back. If you do it right, just let them. My joke is like, it's Ayn Rand meets Mad Max. Like, let them just be wild.
Yeah.
And if you do that and you create a connection properly to the game and you make it so it's, you know, fair and fair balanced, the power isn't really there, but that they're able to have a good authentic, hey, I want to sponsor you. I want to actually handle your ticket purchase for this upcoming game, putting the power in both sides. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's a process of incentivization that can be built into smart contracts and NFTs. These are things, again, when you start understanding how the parts of these things work, you pull them out, you're like, oh, we've just incentivized people wrong. Like, that's all it is. It's this one bit.
That's right.
So throw that out. Here's a new one. Plug in and try to rebuild and figure it out. This is what we try to do. We have this tight economy that is this really weird metagame for people who love metagames. And there's a lot of them out there. The NFT space is, I think, proof of the people who, no one's here because they like the art. Like, that's not a thing. The art is garbage, and they're trying their best to hype up different things and have that conversation, because the game they're playing is, I want my shit to become valuable. I want other shit to become cheaper so I can buy it and pump it back up. I want to trade properly to get my way going. The way that there's that kid who did the trading where he traded for a broken bicycle and then found a way to trade back and forth over 9 months on Craigslist to getting a Porsche. That game is what people are doing in NFT. And so that game just needs to be sealed, made ramified, nice and tight, have its tight rules, and then have the games all around it and allow them to play back and forth. And you can hit this really interesting thing that operates more like sports. FIFA doesn't allow money on the field, which is funny. They have hard rules about every bit of clothing. There was a big scandal a few years ago because one team decided to wear a one piece that I couldn't have even told the difference, but they wore a one piece uniform instead of a two piece. And that was it. And FIFA like sanctioned them. And there was a big deal. And like, oh, but we sent in for approval. And it was this big scandal, but it turned out they had sent in for approval. But like FIFA doesn't allow people to have microtransactions or have economy things change the game. You know, why would they do that? They could make a lot of money. And if there's anything FIFA absolutely does, it's money at any cost. We don't even care. I think there's literal people buried inside of the World Cup stadium that's being made for the next thing. So like,
oh my God,
they don't care. But this is the thing they're ethically like, no, we can't do that. It's because they know that's how you start that slow downhill roll to where we're at in video games, where, you know, an extra $20. Would you like a bonus today? How would you like that? And they're not fun to watch. They're not interesting. You're there kind of in a weird mishmash of emotions, and it's not learning or getting skill. Then they know that would be the end of soccer. That's why all these sports have these rules.
But I do want to say that the idea of sponsorship of virtue is something that has existed in the arts as well as sports and in human endeavor. And so, in a way, if you look at when you say sports, right, like you can say, oh, well, these seats are like $2,000 a pop, but it's like, go to the box seats, you know, like ask how much those are costing, right? How much are the naming rights of the stadium, and who's up there hanging out with like the famous, you know, athletes, right? Like
And what we do is we take that because it's exactly right. Take that. And instead of thinking about it as seats, think about how those, what is that operation? Because what it is it's a handful of people who are way bigger supporters of that stadium and team, putting way more money into that.
That's all it is.
Getting a better experience out of it. Is it that people really want to be in box seats? No, it's fucking not. Like if there was no such thing as space and time, people wouldn't invent box seats. That wouldn't be where we start. We would do a whole bunch of other stuff. But they want to hang out with the athletes. I want to be the cool guys. I want to be in an inner circle. I want to be amongst other people who are hardcore.
I want
this space. This is I want to be on that floor so I can go, hey, Steve, I'm next to you. Oh my God, I'm in the box seats over there. Like they want those moments. They want season ticket holders who were right along the edge of the hockey rink, beating on the walls. They don't want to be on the edge of the hockey rink. They want to be beating on the walls.
That's right.
They want to be with the people who are there. That when you abstract what people are actually getting for these experiences, instead of just taking these weird, very specific instances, which is, it's what like Meta does. If you take a look at their entire play with like what they think the metaverse is going to be, they do the opposite. They abstract nothing. They concretize as much as possible. And it makes everything suck. Like it's just shit wall to wall. No one wants this stuff. No one's dying to like, my joke about the metaverse is we like the ideas of it because of Ready Player One and how it's portrayed, but no one wants to actually walk down alleys. And that's the thing you'd have to have if you just copy how our world works. We would need all of these. No one wants that. So why do we walk anywhere? Well, let's reassess why we like these things. And when we talk about sports at large, just abstract it. Tokenize these things. Change how a person reacts. Have membership passes, for example, that are effectively season passes of various tiers and box seats. And this is very much what we're doing. Our first sets of NFTs are coming out end of this month. We're minting and we're starting a process. We're about to start the story NFTs, which is its own thing. I'd love to get into, but my marketing team and my writers would literally murder me. The top line I can say is, our world is built around those nine immortals I mentioned, the people who've been living, and they get to go first. If we think about everything emanating from the center, which is the intention across everything we do, those nine are in the first little bit. They get to take first shot at things that come. If we have a tournament, everyone who has a pass gets to buy one of whatever we're doing. So the nine get to go first. They're story beats, effectively. I can't talk about who they are, but they're story beats. They're a chance for us to sort of play with the economy, the DAO to control things. But then that next ring is the 81, nine by nine by nine.
So the nine are basically a cross between the Olympians and the ring race.
I would say they're more the gods of Olympus. because how they work, they're not NFTs that will ever be sold. They're locked to the wallets they go in, and they're for my team and I, and for the DAO to use as like story beats. Back when I was working on Star Wars and Project Universe, we had this gigantic database that was intended to be for multiple games to plug into. And the idea was really simple. It would be, we would have role players pretend to be Darth Vader and show up inside of your game and actually have that moment. These are the things people care about. They want to deal with characters. They want to know what's happening. And those characters set the tone for everything that comes after, again, to talk about how story's made. So these 9 do that. The 81, will be, we're whitelisting all of our investment group, if you know anyone, to get one of these 81, they're the people who will then go first. They are our box seats. They are that. They are the top tier. Then around them, we have 729. The 729 are, think of it as the hardcore guys up against the front, who there's a lot of them, there's more, but they're not the 81. They're certainly not the 9. They get to go next, and kind of this trickling effect of how a membership club can operate and how people can kind of play inside of that economy at different tiers.
So, this is the juicy stuff, and I, this is a great, great place, but I got to round out for time's sake. Where can people find you and this? And let's close on that note.
Welcome to Noor. Welcome to Noor.com is the easy thing for the site. I am on Twitter as Play is Free, because I believe play is free. That's kind of the easiest bet to find out all of our stuff, to find us on social, on Discord. You know what? We have a vanity URL. I haven't checked it in a while. I'm pretty sure it's just flat out discord.gg/Noor, which I think is nice and boring.
N-O-R, right?
It is N-O-R, yes.
Great, perfect.
So that's where you can find us. We're strong. We have our whitelists are closed for the 729, but within a few weeks, we're going to be opening it up for the 6,000, the next tier, the next circle of 9. So it's 9 times that. And then after that, we're going to be doing basically a series of very large ones as we round out the last circle. Just to mention, though, and that's it, our economy is going to be cut off because, to your point, there is scarcity in some way. People, like, to me, the metaverse at a base level, people misunderstand. They think it's a city people go to. And to me, people are the metaverse. You yourself, by what you do every day, you go between worlds without even thinking about it. You don't even notice that you're doing this. I'm doing it here. I'm going to go play a video game. I'm going to go to Slack, and then I'm going to go play some WoW. I am a metaverse. I exist between them. And the more that we can make that powerful, the more that we can touch into humans, for sure.
I love it. Well, good. Welcome to Noor.com. Everybody should go check it out. And, Brooks, definitely welcome back to come back on the show anytime.
I would absolutely love to. And someday I will not be quite as long-winded.
No, it's a beautiful show and wonderful topic. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me very much.
Okay, bye.